I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I find it very hard to believe that tonight is the last lecture of our fall season. I want to remind you, though, that the galleries actually stay open until 7 p.m. Through November. So take advantage. You might get to actually just be all by yourself with your favorite work of art on a Tuesday night. So come back for that. Have a nice solitary time with the Susan Rothenberg Moving in Place, or as I said, maybe some favorite piece out of the collection. We will begin the lectures again in February. With that, I want to announce that Amy Blakemore, the photographer from Houston, who currently has a survey show up at the MFA and was scheduled to come this fall. Her lecture was canceled because her flight didn't get out of Houston. We have rescheduled her for the spring, so for this coming season. So it looks like it's going to be in March, but I don't have a definite date, or I don't want to give you a definite date in case it changes. So check the website, and or if you're members, of course, you'll be getting the calendar, which will have the listings of the Tuesday evenings. And then hopefully you're on the email list, so you're getting all kinds of program announcements through membership if you're a member. Tuesday evenings, there are a few new faces in the audience tonight, so I just want to go over real quickly to let some of you know that Tuesday evenings is this ongoing lecture series that we are proud to have offered free and open to the public each fall and each spring for more than 15 years now. I can hardly believe it. And I've been here for 15, and it was happening before me. And I think it's a program that continues, in fact, I know it's a program that continues to be relevant, fresh, enlightening, and sometimes entertaining, thanks to the diversity each week offers. As well, of course, as the enormous talent we have been able to bring in from our own community and afar. And tonight is no exception. Tony Sherman is here from afar. Tony is a painter extraordinaire, born in Toronto, educated in London, with an MA from the Royal College of Art, and now back living and working in Toronto, in Canada. His vita is extensive, with solo and group exhibitions throughout North America and Europe. To name a few of his most recent solo exhibitions, there is Tony Sherman Drawings this year at Art Palace in Nova Scotia, and About 1865, the title of an exhibition, a remarkable exhibition from 2008 of paintings and drawings that takes images and symbols of the American Civil War as their subject, not in the manner of a traditional history painting, but as Tony has explained, as interrogation, meditation, and a poem. We will find out more tonight, but it seems to me that Tony works on themed bodies of work that can often be understood as, in fact, an interrogation, a meditation, a poem. There are the Napoleon paintings, the paintings of Lincoln, which in fact are part of the Civil War paintings, and the Junkies series that is what introduced me to Tony's work last year when I saw a beautiful, disturbing painting of Marilyn Monroe's seductive, heavy-lidded eyes in Warhol, the shared subject at TCU's Fort Worth Contemporary. I also had the great pleasure of hearing Tony speak on the subject of that exhibition as part of a panel. Clearly an erudite and with tremendous passion for his subject and his medium, which is encaustics, for which I have to say he is the contemporary standard. As I said, Tony's vita is packed with exhibitions, articles, essays, publications, and various forms of recognition. He has taught and lectured in universities and art institutions almost continuously since receiving his MA in 1974. And his work has been placed in very impressive public and private collections. But it is that painting of Marilyn, his comments on that panel, and a little bit of dinner conversation afterwards that prompted me to invite him here tonight. And I am so glad that he accepted my invitation to be the season's grand finale. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Tony Sherman.
Thank you. Thank you, very much. Can you hear me? Yep. I want to thank you for inviting me. I was most honored. I want to thank John Runyon, my dealer here, who's makes working in the art world so much nicer. So thank you, John, very much. I wanted to talk to you tonight about, instead of doing a lecture about, you know, what I've done, you know, click, 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 I wanted to bring up certain problems in painting, really problems in painting, and also talk to you about some themes that I've worked on and I'm working on. So this will be a fairly philosophical discussion, but hopefully clear. Can we cut the lights? Thank you. I want to begin, first of all, with a couple of ideas that struck me when I was, from a very early age, going to museums and looking at painting from the age of six on. And by the time I'm at art school in England in the 1970s, there is, I'm beginning to come to a formulation around painting, which is really the coming into to the DNA of painting. That would be the structure, the underlying structure that I'm actually responding to. And the best way I can put this is that painting, whether it's a good painting, bad painting, any kind of painting, is an always already resolved paradox. And the paradox that is already resolved is that when I put a mark down, I'm affirming the surface. And we can call this surface affirming. Right? It's on the surface, it's part of this world. But at the very same time, that mark is going to create a notional space, what we call pictorial space. Now, this is actually an extraordinary event because it's already resolved. Right? In other words, I don't have to resolve it when I look at it. It's already resolved in the act of doing it. Do you follow what I'm saying here? This is actually really big news. And in fact, the history of Western painting, as it develops through into the technologies of the 18th, 17th centuries, really begins to focus more and more on this extraordinary resolve paradox, until when we come into the 20th century, it busts wide open, right, into pure abstraction, which is then going to try and claim, right, the surface only, all right, without the denying, which it fails in. So there's that. When I'm at the Royal College, I'm doing a painting degree. I have painter's block. I just can't paint. I don't paint for 2 years. I draw, and I draw still lives. I draw from the model, and I'm working with wax crayons. And my tutor, John Golding, who wrote the still is the definitive text on cubism, said to me, "You know, you've got a painting degree. If you don't paint, you're not going to get your degree." I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, why don't you try encaustic?" I'd seen a couple of Johnses at the Tate. They were already falling apart. And, you know, I was kind of intrigued. I said, "Well, how do you use it?" He said, I have no idea. There's a guy in the studio who said, yeah, I know. You get some paraffin wax, go to the chemist, pharmacy, and get some pigment and melt it and just... And I went it, and I got that. And I remember I drew up a kind of a still life drawing, and I melted, I put some alizarin crimson in, and it went like, And I picked it up and I went, and it dried immediately. It dripped and it had a thickness to it. And the thickness said to me, I am. Right? I am. I am in this world. And I thought, my God, this is the medium I will use until I die. Because I would now have to really, this was the greatest torque that I could find to articulate surface affirming and surface denying. All right, I'd set myself up to climb a K2 bare feet, basically. Right, my draftsmanship wasn't very good. I wasn't that talented, so it was. You know, I sort of also at the same time had handicapped myself in case I failed. Right, because if I failed, well, the guy's using encaustic. I mean, all right. I'm not going to try. I'm going to try and tell you the truth tonight. That's really how I start working with this medium, and an extraordinary medium it is. I'm going to now take you to the. There's one other thing. There is the history. There is in the history of art. There are two histories. There is the history of the what and the history of the how. The history of the what is the province of art history, art historians, curators, museum people, in fact, everybody in the art world who doesn't actually make. Right? The history of the how is a history that's passed down from artist to artist. It's passed down verbally, it's passed down through intuition, it is rarely written. My father was a musician, conductor, he's a violinist, and he used to be, you know, have people over, they play quartets, and over the years, and these were great musicians, and I never heard them talk about the art of music or music, or no, they just talked about bowing and fingering, right? Let me give you an example, because this was something that was germane in my work. I'll give you an example of the difference. In the late 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, artists start to dim the lights in the paintings, and we have the birth of chiaroscuro, darkness, right? And art history has always passed on the idea and written extensively about the idea that the artists were really bringing out what at that time was humanism, and that this humanism was really to zero in on the being, on the ontos of the person, right, and to really check, right? But in fact, painters know that that isn't actually what happened. Until then, painters, when they painted a portrait, always had to paint all the iconography around the portrait, right? Of, you know, where the guy lived, his lands, you know, his, right, his chachkas, all kinds of stuff, right? And they had to paint all this stuff. And at a certain point, they said, we don't want to paint this stuff anymore. We're sick of it. And they turned the lights out. All right? They literally turned the lights out. So that the painters could then just paint what they wanted to paint and not have to paint all this other stuff. Do you see where I'm going here? So you have these two histories. So with that in mind, right. Here's a painting from the around 2000 of Napoleon Bonaparte, a young Bonaparte. And this brings up the first question in painting, and that is the question of figure and ground, right? One of the great problems in Western art has always been figure and ground. I paint a figure, I have to put it somewhere, right? And that very idea of cutting the lights, right, is you know, solving part of that problem. What I did at this point, and I'd been doing it before, was to create a new ground, and the ground here was the canvas and the parts of the face that aren't actually looked at very much. And in fact, in these portraits, and this is about this size, this portrait, the eyes, the nose, and the mouth become the figures, right, on this ground. Because in fact, really after the death of Giacometti, but certainly the death of Bacon, we move out of the era of the head and into the era of the face, right? We're in the era of the face. And so it struck me that portraiture now would at least in part have to, for me, deal with face, right? So this is how I dealt with it. This is a horse, a painting of a horse from the same series of the French Revolution. When I painted the French Revolution, I folded, I conflated the period in the French Revolution of the Terror with the Nazi regime. It was very, very close. There were a lot of fold-ins. And there was a town called Oradour in the Dordogne in France. And in 1944, when the Germans leave France on a retreat, the Waffen-SS come into this town and they wipe the town out. They burn everything in it to the ground. They take the women and children, they burn them in a church, and they rifle all the men. If you go to Oradour now, there's all there is the empty shells of the buildings kept as a kind of memorial. There's basically nothing there. So I painted this painting of this horse to signify the absence of Oradour. So we come to the second idea here, and that is meaning in painting. Right? I'm taking you through ideas that I've been thinking about over the years, right? Meaning in painting. When I showed this painting in Paris, it had a tremendous amount of meaning. The French remember Oradour as was yesterday, and it was a very poignant painting. The painting then gets bought by a collector in Los Angeles who has horses, and he doesn't know anything about Oradour, and he doesn't care anything about Oradour, right? For him, it's a horse painting, right? I'm bringing this slide up because this is, in fact, the history of what happens to art, is that when art comes out into the world, it comes out as a sign. It comes out, the body of the work is the signifier, the painting itself, the body of the thing. And then what is signified, which is, in this case, Oradour, right? So the horse signifies Oradour, and it forms a sign. Now, what happens over time with all art is that the signification starts to break away. And what we're left with in the end is the form. If you go to the Louvre and look at Poussin's painting of the Rape of the Sabine Women, when that painting was painted, everybody knew the story because everybody was schooled in the story of Rome. We go now, we don't know the story. We look at the form, all right? So what I'm talking about here is the built-in obsolescence of meaning, right? And the taking on of other meanings, all right? And this could be a major crisis. In fact, I think the crisis has already begun in contemporary art, because in my work, I already accept that. I accept the dissolve right away. It's already built into the paintings. It's a horse painting. And the fact that somebody just loves it for its horse doesn't bother me at all. I don't try and hold on or tell them, no, it's Oradour, you have to keep the meaning. But you can imagine all the art that is produced where the meaning is very, very important to its, the form does not necessarily carry a lot, right, beyond the meaning. And so if that work were to find itself in different situations, it might start to leak out meaning, right, which is a particular interest. This is from a series called About 1865, about the Civil War. This painting is called Georgia. Sort of speaks for itself, the Sherman's march through Georgia. And this painting if I look at this painting, this is a painting that I can address another issue on, and that is, when you look at some of my work, there are sort of, it's a little kind of, it can sit uneasily for a moment, because it's painted with, I say, the technologies of the 18th, 19th, 17th century. But, so it's sort of like old-fashioned, but at the same time, it's sort of new. It's a kind of strange. If you look at the pictorial space in this painting is actually not in the space of painting. It's in the space of cinema. This is a zoom lens, right? And in fact, all the paintings are shortened depths of field. So in all the paintings, I'm getting two messages. I'm getting the message of its structure, and I'm also getting this contradictory message of the space, because it's not the space in which those structures were actually operating in, right? This is the space, okay? So there's a conflation of two kind of orders, if you like, which creates... So this is the stuff I'm thinking about while I'm painting, right? Is to how to torque, how to accentuate these what's going on in my head when I'm looking at the painting, what my response to the painting is, all right? So that the painting begins to throw out meaning. It becomes a true metaphor, all right? Because of these paradoxes. This painting of this young black girl, African American, sorry, with her face wiped out from the same series of the Civil War. This painting is called Walk on No Lines, which is a term in movie making when you are just a walk on and you have no lines. While I was painting, and while I was researching the Civil War and looking at it, and again, you can go to my website. It's all on the website. So this is just, if this interests you, you can go and see the other paintings. And what you'll see in this series is the paintings of the white guys, the white men. When I think of the war, when people generally think of the Civil War, they think of the North and the South fighting, and they think of Lee, and they think of, you know, Lincoln, and right? How do I paint the reason for the war? How do I paint the actual subject of the war? All right. I mean, how do I do that? I paint this girl and I paint her face. But in painting the face, I'm now painting something that is ultimately too specific. She's not standing in for this theme, right? Because she is now specific. So I have to now paint a universal, right? And so I wiped her face off. And in the moment of wiping her face off, and this is a strange business, because with the wax, I put this stuff on hot. I mix it with oil paint and I put it on hot, and it dries and it drips. And then I have to burn it out or scrape it or blowtorch it if I make mistakes, which is all the time. And when If I burn something off like that, there's a great risk that the iron might be just a little too hot and it'll wipe off the whole thing, right? So in this case, it worked, because in other cases, it just blows the whole thing, right? It worked. And what it did, there was a double metaphor for me. There was the wiping off of her identity. Right, it was a complete wiping off of her identity, which is exactly the reality of this extraordinary war. Right, is that these people, you know, these slaves, they're just the slaves, you know, and she became a universal. She could stand in for something. It's a detail. You can see how, you know, it's very chaotic at the surface, right? This stuff. Right, now we come to something quite different. I don't know if there are any philosophy students here or philosophy majors. The great philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote three great critiques, and then the third critique, the critique of judgment, he writes about an extraordinary piece of writing around a flower. And he says, when we look at a field of wild flowers, there's no beginning, there's no end, they have no meaning, they are just, right? And he basically hands that over to God. Right. In other words, there's nothing finite here. All right. There's no meaning. There's no reason. But the moment I cut the flower, everything is different. All right. By cutting the flower, I not only kill the flower, but I bring it into the human realm. Right. And in fact, its beauty changes. Right. Its whole ontos, its whole being changes. So, I pick this up. Jacques Derrida writes on this, a French philosopher, and here's how this goes. I'm doing a show in Amsterdam in 1991. I'm sitting in my hotel lobby. I'm in the capital of cut flowers, and I'm whacked out of my mind. I'm stoned, and I'm looking at these flowers. I'm surrounded by these cut flowers. And I start thinking, what are they doing? They're doing something. They're not just symbolic. They're doing something, right? Because I'm now thinking about all the uses that cut flowers have in our culture, right across the cultures, right? Cultures that never spoke to each other use flowers. And then I'm thinking about how they're used. They're used for celebration. They're used as solace. They're used, you know, in death. They're used in the family, in a bowl, right? They're used in all these different ways that bring us comfort. And then I start speculating that there are a group of cut flowers in a florist with all the other cut flowers. And in fact, what these are signifiers that have no signification. They're bodies just waiting for an assignation, right? So I get up in the morning and I walk down with the intention of going to a funeral and buying the flowers. So here you have the floating signifier that has no meaning, awaiting a meaning. The meaning is now walking down the street, right? I buy the flowers, I buy a group of these flowers for a funeral. The moment I buy them, they become a sign. They are now locked, all right? And the moment flowers become locked in whatever the meaning is, right? Whether it's for a birth, a wedding, a funeral. The moment they become a sign, something really strange happens. They become sacred. They become sacred to that sign. What I mean by that is, I can't change the sign. Once a group of flowers have been given their job, if you like, or their signification, that can't change. So I thought, what would happen if I went to a funeral and I put the flowers down and then I double back afterwards and I pick them up and I bring them to a dinner party? All right. That is the conversation with the devil. That is this series called The Conversation with the Devil. This is a series that's been going on since 1991, and I will paint them probably until I die. This is my meditation on ethics. This is my meditation on starting from there. What is really going on here? What is really at stake here? Right? Is this real or is this not? Is this just a convention, or do you see where I'm going here? This opens up for me a discussion. And so, as you probably noticed by now, when I choose these series and themes, these are meditations for me. These are, when I paint these things, this is what I am in, right? And so when I paint flowers, this is where I am. And when I paint something else, this is where where I am. So it's a long series of cut flowers, some in vases, most of them. You see, in this form, this has an assignation. This is in the home. This is the hearth. This has a meaning that has to do with that. Right. The detail here. Encaustic is a terrible medium. It's the worst medium ever invented. It was used in ancient Greece. It was then used in Roman painting. But it died off because it's no good. And I always dissuade students from using it. So here you, in a painting like this, you can really see the surface affirming and the surface denying. I mean, here the surface is just not letting up. And yet, I can see a flower in space, right? This kind of, the torquing of this isn't mannerism, because, I mean, in the sense that I'm not searching for ways to thicken up the surface or make it more present. It's just the medium itself. Some of these paintings are very thin, some get very thick, just depending on what's happening. But that's, you know, I mean, if you were to think of the kind of theoretical position of my paintings, this one would hold it. Right? This would be it. They're very minimal. I never paint two people. I only paint one on one. The portraits, if they're looking at you, are, there's only you and the eye. There's nothing else. There's no iconography. There's nothing else, nowhere else to go. Right? It's a complete collapse of the standard triangle in painting, where you have a figure, say in a portrait, looking at you, surrounded by a correlative field of stuff that you can then bounce off. Right? Or in certain paintings where you have a figure looking out at you, right? From not the main figure. The main figure might be doing something and somebody in the scene is looking out at you, right? Which forms a triangle. I've collapsed these triangles. There are a lot of floating ones. These are just the signifiers. They have no assignation. Right? So it then becomes that becomes a discussion within the discussion. Right? As to what it is that I'm painting. Right? Is there any meaning here? I mean, I don't know. You know, some people, I mean, I had a show in New York a few years ago. I was, an artist who, very good artist, very well-known artist, a friend of mine passed by and he said, she looked at a flower painting, she went, "Oh God, you've got a lot of guts." And I thought, yes, this is exactly what I want to hear. This is exactly part of that conversation. Right, because what she was saying was, it's very dangerous to paint flower paintings and be taken seriously. Right, they are the bottom of the barrel. Okay, you're slumming. You are you're eating hamburger in a fancy restaurant. Okay, and so what would be dangerous to me is an opening. Right, and what are we talking? What's at stake here? Right, I mean, give me a break. Right, but in the way the art world is constructed, these things become major dangers for artists. Right, don't sleep with the wrong gallery, and da, you know, it's like endless. Okay, and so what you paint, you know, one of the things that changed dramatically over the last century is that what you paint becomes a signifier of the intelligence of the artist. And this is a very interesting kind of turn. In other words, in the 20th century, particularly in figuration, which is the weakest strain, right? I mean, if we're looking at strains, the smart money is not on figuration. and the artists who are espousing the spirit of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, are moving into other areas. Figurative painting is held in the 20th century, particularly the post-war period, generally speaking, by weaker artists, artists who are not they're trained, but they're not risking anything. They're not pushing the discourse further because there's no critical forum for it, right? So, as a figurative painter, what becomes treacherous for me becomes material, right? This is food for me, right? Now we come to the last series, the one I'm working on now, which is the Odyssey. The Odyssey, extraordinary story of Odysseus. Some of you may remember, but I'll bring you up to speed. The story of Odysseus, the story of the champion of Troy, the Trojan horse guy, who's on his way back to Ithaca. He's been gone for 10 years. He needs to see his wife and his child and resume his kingship. And he leaves Troy with his crew, and the second night on his way home, and he's aching to see his wife. The second night on the way home, they come onto an island, and they see some sheep on the island, and they start stealing the sheep off the island. And while they're stealing the sheep off the island, the crew happen to see this footprint. I mean, a really big footprint, and a human footprint. And they say, let's get off this island. This is bad news. Don't want to know. Odysseus can't resist checking it out, right? Now, he just can't resist it. He's an adventurer. He suffers from hubris. So he gets sidetracked, and he takes a group of them. They follow the footprints, they lead them to a cavern, they go into the cavern, they see cheese, they see goats, they start getting ready to steal everything, and suddenly this one-eyed giant comes in. His name is Polythemus, he's a cyclop, he's a child of Poseidon, the god of the sea. He locks them in, he's pissed off because they're stealing his stuff, he starts eating the crew. They get him drunk by a ruse, and while Polythemus is sleeping in his drunken stupor, they take a burning ember and they poke his eye out. They get off the island. Poseidon is so upset with what they did to his son. He basically tells Odysseus, there's no way you're getting home. I'm going to screw you up 10 ways till Sunday. I'm going to teach you a lesson that you will never forget. Now, there's a little rule on Mount Olympus that you can't zap a human directly. You can only cause causal agency. So Poseidon, from then on, the story that we know of the Odyssey is the story of one man's will, a mortal's will to get home, and a god's will to stop him. All right? So we have scale here in this story. And when you read the text, every other page, they can't get home because they're drunk, because the food is so good, because the sex is so good. All right? This is famous. The Odyssey is famous for having more booze, more sex, and more food in it than any other epic poem. In fact, what Poseidon throws at Odysseus, right, is all this stuff, including opium, in order to make him forget to go home. He puts him to sleep. Right? Now, eventually he gets home with the help of Athena, another god. But But the so this is the ostensive reading. Okay, this is what we can see. I mean, I've gone a little deeper there, right, than what's maybe necessarily obvious. But when I'm reading this, and I've been reading this for many decades, I knew I wanted to paint it, but I wasn't ready yet. Until I realized there are esoteric readings, deeper, much, much deeper readings. There's a much deeper metaphor at work here. And that metaphor is the metaphor of waking up, the waking up of consciousness. That in fact, Odysseus is asleep and he wakes up from time to time and remembers he has to go home. That's what he wants. This is what he wants to do. He wants to go home. He's yearning for his wife. But then, look at this, right? Okay? So we're looking at the human condition here, but what is going on is this is a story about sleep and moments of awakening. So, this is Circe. This is one of the portraits of Circe. It's one of those big walk-in portraits like this. This is one of the incarnations. She is one of the sort of the witch that pulls him in. She turns his crew into pigs, and in order to get them returned back so they can get home, he has to sleep with her, and he sleeps with her for 5 days, but actually it's 6 months. She's completely bewitched him. So there's Circe. And here's a... This is what I'm looking at when I'm painting these things, all right? If you see one of the paintings, this is what they look up close up if they get to this stage of guck. The light refracts through this medium quite wonderfully, but it's also very treacherous. Depending on the light, it'll change and become quite flat and abstract, and then you can see the light again. Here's another incarnation of Circe, right? Circe is all things to all men. So Circe will undergo all kinds of incarnations in my series. And now we come to this shrimp. I mean, it's a sea story. He's on the sea all the time, right? We come to this shrimp. It's a broken shrimp. Sort of floating in the blackness of the paint. It's a detail. This is one of the still lives that will be painted in the series of excess, serious excess. Beets, goat's cheese, asparagus. There are sides of meat. There are all kinds of things. And then as you walk up to the painting, all right. So this is the punctum. This is the moment when I'm looking at the painting and then I notice that there's a rip in it. And just for that moment, just for that nanosecond, I'm awake. And then I fall back to sleep again. I start talking about it. What does it mean? Da da da. You know, what's Tony doing? He's gone off his rocker. He's desperate. He's craving attention. He's, you know, how could he slash his own paintings? Whatever, right? All kinds of meanings. But by then I'm already into the sleep that I've been, that basically I've sort of put you in for the last 45 minutes, right? Right? And then, and put myself into, right? And then there's this kind of moment. young Hermes, the messenger of the gods. You know, in the post-war period, in fact, in the 20th century, after Wittgenstein, after Freud, after post-structuralism, it becomes very, very difficult to take what somebody says at face value. In other words, we have now a distrust of manifest content. All right. In these myths, and in this myth, there's a moment where Hermes brings Odysseus a set of instructions on how to survive from Zeus to help him. And I'm wondering now, how could Hermes bring him the exact correct message? It's not possible. In other words, Hermes will paraphrase what Zeus said, and there will be a tone in his voice. And between the paraphrasing and the tone, his subconscious agenda will be playing out in the message that he is now passing on. Right? Because the interesting thing in the Odyssey is that he brings him a message that this doesn't really work. Right? And there's a cut in the back there, just where the body meets the... And here's the last painting. This is about the size. This painting is called Troy. The Greeks... You know, Troy is this glorious kingdom led by a great king, Priam. They have an extraordinary culture. They've never been taken. And just through the ambition of Agamemnon, the Greeks finally destroy this city, completely destroy it, rape everything in it. So in this painting of Troy, there's a double tragedy. I mean, there is the tragedy of the death of Troy, this magnificent beast. But there's a double tragedy because there are cuts in it. Right. Now, so the cut in this painting there's that moment. But then there's also the moment of how could you? How could I? When I decided to cut this painting, it took me 3 days because I loved this painting. It was a great painting. I loved this painting, and I thought, how am I going to cut this painting? And I had this very difficult discussion about, you know, am I off my rocker? What am I doing? You know, this is insane. On the one hand, on the other hand, profoundly knowing what I'm doing, right? Because this is my odyssey as an artist. I'm, in fact, right? And the cutting of this painting is very close to the moment of Odysseus looking at the footprint and not being able to resist it. Right. I finally cut it. And in the cutting of it, I experienced the greatest buzz I've ever had in my life. And I was a 37-year junkie, hardcore, 2 rehabs. And in cutting this, I couldn't believe how high I got in this moment. This is a moment of complete liberation. Right. Now, I come back into the studio and I look at this painting and I look at the other paintings with the rips in them, and every time I look at them, I thought I would be used to the rip by now. You know, you do something and then you get used to it, right? It's like, you know, people in battle, you get used to dead bodies, whatever. You kind of get used to it. I haven't. because this puncturing of my own toil, right? Of my own. This is really strange territory. But it's the territory I'm in, and this is what I'm doing. So on that note, I thank you, and I'll take some questions. Yeah. Do ask some questions. Yeah. Yeah.
What kinds of tools do you use to spread the encaustic on? Because it is rather difficult. And I remember that you mentioned that you mix oil paint and with the encaustic.
Yeah.
But, okay, so tools and then also, do you paint on top of it?
Okay, so I take a canvas. I use cotton instead of linen because linen moves too much with the humidity. I used to use beeswax. I now use microcrystalline wax. So I changed the medium. I mean, when I started doing this, nobody was working at it. Jasper Johns was working at it. So I'm really I reinvented this medium and have actually taken it where nobody has gone. And people ask about the technique, and they're very disappointed because there's nothing going on. I take some microcrystalline wax, right, that has some tack. It comes in different hardnesses. That's the wax that you put on, they use it for makeup or spraying fruit, and then you can get it harder and harder. The harder it gets, the more brittle it is. You go from a long chain molecule to a short chain molecule. So basically I take a sort of, right, one that's, I melt it, I put it on the canvas with a brush, a painter's brush. It dries, then I do that flat, then I put the painting up and I paint right on it with a brush. It's just oil, paint, wax, and a brush. Right? If I make a mistake, which is all the time, I then go over it or I scrape it down if it's still warm, or I scrape it down after it's warm, or I use an iron to get through it, or a blowtorch, or I scrape. Right? So what happens in the paintings is that they build up a kind of archaeology. Right? That's it. It's very simple. I don't fuse it afterwards. Sorry, did you ask? Now, up with me, it might have, you know, but people like, they'll figure it out. It won't crack. The formula that I've got, I've worked with some very good chemists in restoration, and it's good. Anybody? Yeah.
When you paint, how do you get there? Do you sketch something, or is it just coming out of your...
No, I sketch. If I'm doing a painting of, I didn't show you the junkies because I didn't have enough time. But if I'm doing a portrait of somebody, I will use a photograph that I've taken or somebody else's taken, and I'll blow it up. Right, I'll grid it up. Okay, I won't paint from a photo on the canvas. I grid it up, and then it's alla prima. Right, so unlike say Chuck Close. Right, who will grid up his image and then fill in, right? Or like how they did Mount Rushmore. Okay, they did little section by section, right? I don't work like that. I have to sort of calibrate my internal instruments to know where I am. And then at the surface, I can't see, right? Because the eye of the bull is this big. So, but because of the medium, I am painting the painting as though it was an easel painting, and I was painting with oil paint. You see where I'm going? So it's very peripatetic. I mean, if I was an easel painter, I'd weigh 400 pounds. I mean, I walk back and forth and back and forth, and it's a very strange medium. It's very slow, and then it's hysterical. Right, it's slow because every time I change a color, I have to get some toilet paper, wipe off the pan, put some fresh wax. Right, so that's all very slow. Then I get to I get there, and I go, and it's like super fast. Right, I have to make all these decisions and get it right, but I can't see where I am because then I have to go back and redraw, regrid up on the painting as I'm going, so I don't lose my coordinates completely. Sometimes I do; the thing gets completely distorted. I don't notice the distortion for a couple of weeks. I go for coffee. I come back. Ah, right. So. No, he was there, but Blake is an illustrator, and the problems that Blake was dealing with were not of interest to me. I mean, I was looking at Velasquez, right? Not Blake. I mean, you're obviously aware there's a very strong metaphysical presence in the work, but it was not the metaphysics of Blake grounded in that theology. Yeah.
The rosebuds you've gathered. Can you talk about, say, punk painting, Dutch painting, and then.
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
Where the cut flowers mean several things at once that they signify, if we're going to use that, several things at once. You know, they might. Indicate luxury and bourgeois achievements, but they also are
momentum work. Well, there's another layer, right, in these paintings, because what I'm painting are dying sex organs, right? That's what they are. Okay. There's a cult. In European painting of flower paintings, there are schools of flower painters, and flower painting is a very strange. It has a very strange place in the history of Western art, right? Unlike the other genre, right, which are the other typologies, if you like. How these work in they are. Probably very much in that tradition, right? Taking it from a different place. Those flower paintings are in dark grounds, meaning there is no light. These flower paintings are in black grounds, not dark grounds. This is black, okay? So let me just go back to, yeah. This is black. Now, in my paintings, the blackness has two valences. Right? One is it is the color black, the actual color black. It is also the absence of light, right? But black is the total absence of light, complete absence of light. Something we actually experience very rarely. Very rarely, because of night pollution and stuff. I mean, you know, if you go into a cupboard or go into a room and absolutely tape it, absolutely, you can't see a thing. It is black, all right? That's the blackness of these paintings. Now, it is not because I'm not Gothic, right? I'm not a Gothic creature, right? This isn't about... that it's about the blackness of the paint, and the blackness, it's the only color that has this valence, right? That the color it is also the thing that it is, right? Completely. so completely. There is, let me put it to another way. When I draw, right, somebody has lit the universe before I arrive. Right? Theologically, drawing is the human being passing through a lit universe, which is the white of the paper, right? The light of the paper. And I take light out. But entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, is absolutely up and running. If I take all the light out, it's black. There's dark. And I can't take any more out. So drawing and the history of drawing is contingent. I'm just passing through. I'm taking some light out, right? Actually, digitally, and also metaphorically if I'm describing the absence of light. But when I paint, I am God. I light the universe, and I also take light out of the universe. The arrow of time does not observe entropy. It goes in two directions. It's eternal. I can put light in and take it out, put it in and take it out. So the absoluteness of the black, right, apart from its psychic reading, right, is when I'm painting on the black, I'm painting on something that is very terminal. Let me put it that way, right? I can only talk around the subject.
Well, when you talk about black, I just would say to me, it makes the flowers more fluorescent.
Yes, as though generated by their own light.
Yeah, they seem more, I don't know, metaphorically, they may be dying, but they seem entirely fluorescent.
Well, I'm glad, everything turns into its opposite. Absolutely. Anybody else? Did I miss anything? Yes.
Could you just close with this? This notion at the end when you're talking about your latest series, is that something that in looking back you now recognize as being in play from the beginning, this notion of sleep and wake?
Absolutely.
Does it have anything to do with your appeal, the appeal of acoustic to you? Is that when you are did your experience with that?
There's no question that the first time I used it, no question. I am interested in waking up. But what I wake up to is my sleep. I don't wake up to some nirvana. I actually wake up to what I am, right? And what I am is a sleeping being, right? A profound sleep. I mean, I'm talking about profound sleep. I mean, I walk, I talk, I paint, I do all kinds of things, and I have no idea I'm doing them, right? And occasionally, life offers me a situation, quite often a very painful one, but a situation where I'm forced to wake up. Absolutely. But it's not just when you look at the canvas, when you look at a painting, take a painting that is so carefully painted, right, that has a value, $60,000, right? And then to slash that, right, to cut it, I can't not wake up at that point.
That cut makes it more real, getting back to the original.
Well, there we go, right? So this, right? Yes, it does make it more real, but it's also a peek into, or a peek through, right? It's like piercing through Maya for 2 seconds. And then I fall asleep again. Right? In other words, I see the rip, and it's like, God, it's so weird, right? It doesn't really interfere with the painting; it's sort of part of the painting, but it's not. It's a punctum, right? It's a passage through scale, I mean, the only thing, I will leave you with one thought. For some of us who've been very, very fortunate, and for those who haven't, I wish this for all of you, or anybody, that maybe you've stood outside or lain down in a summer sky, maybe, and seen the stars. And the stars are there, and then suddenly, for a nanosecond, you suddenly realize where you actually are. I don't know if anybody's had that experience, but if you've had, you'll never forget it. Because what's actually happening at that moment is that you are tapping into the next scale, the next order of magnitude. You're actually now sensing yourself in the universe. That is real. They're not stars. No, my God, I'm actually here. Right? That's what this is. Right? It's just a moment. It's a nanosecond. So there you go. Thank you.